Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's being called a triple threat. Along with the ongoing cases of COVID and seasonal flu, the CDC is seeing an increase in ER visits and hospitalizations across the country due to a common respiratory illness called RSV. The virus usually causes mild, cold-like symptoms, but can be more serious in young children and older adults. Pediatric hospitals across the country are reporting unusually high RSV case numbers, and some are overwhelmed with the number of patients they're receiving. Today, we're going to get a better understanding of what RSV is and why parts of the country are seeing so many cases this early in the season, as well as what families should know as we head into the holidays. Joining us today are two pediatric hospitalists from our region whose communities have seen an uptick in RSV cases in recent weeks. Dr. Nicole Webb is with Valley Children's Health in Merced County, and Dr. Bronwyn Carlson is with Renowned Children's Hospital in Reno. Dr. Webb and Carlson, welcome to Insight. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, let's head down to the Central Valley in Merced County. Dr. Webb, for our listeners who may not know, I mean, I had to look up what RSV was when I first was seeing headlines of it. What exactly is RSV?
Yeah, that's a great question. And then just as a quick clarification, I actually am in Madera County, although we cover the entire San Joaquin Valley at our institution. So RSV stands for respiratory syncytial virus, which is a mouthful, and that's why we call it RSV. It is a very, very common respiratory virus that causes a predictable pattern of symptoms and typically circulates in a seasonal fashion. So to an older child or an adult, it's just a cold and you would never know that you had it because you wouldn't necessarily be ill enough to come to medical attention and get a test for it. In infants and children, typically under the age of 2, it causes a phenomenon known as bronchiolitis, which is really inflammation of the small airways in the lungs. And that is really driven by a lot of mucus that builds up and can cause difficulty breathing. So to a parent, what that looks like is a child who starts off with a cold and some congestion, is really snotty, might have some fever. And then in a majority of cases, that's all it is. But in our younger children in particular, it often progresses to really trouble breathing. That is often why they end up seeking medical attention, particularly at an emergency department or in a hospital such as where Dr. Bronwyn and I work.
Yeah. Dr. Carlson in Reno, what are you seeing in terms of cases with RSV in your community, and how is it impacting the acute care department at your hospital, Renown?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we are just starting to see an uptick in our RSV cases. We know that the general predictable trend is that it starts out in the East Coast and hits there first, usually because they get the colder weather, and usually RSV is typically seen during the cold weather season. And so it, you know, usually starts on the East Coast and then moves its way across the country and out west. So we have not hit a complete surge the way that the East Coast has been seeing over the past several weeks, but our numbers are definitely ticking up. You know, we know that for the state of Nevada, our case positivity has gone from less than 1% to about 8% over the past several weeks. And, you know, our hospital is then being impacted by that. You know, we have about half of our pediatric patients in the general pediatrics unit are positive for RSV right now. And in our PICU, it's actually about 3/4 of them. So we definitely are seeing more and more RSV, but we have not gotten the volume, that kind of wave of volume that the East Coast has seen so far.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I was going to go to you and see if you were seeing the same trend, Dr. Webb, in the Central Valley, because your hospital told us the positivity rate was around 10% earlier in October, but it went up to like 19% about 2 weeks ago. Where does that stand now?
Yeah, I apologize for being overly eager there. Yes. So we went from about 10% 2 weeks ago to 23% last week, actually. Very similar to Dr. Carlson. I actually am on clinical service right now. So I just left several RSV patients to come talk to you. So we have really seen a huge uptick in our region. Our kind of proportion of our patients who are hospitalized is pretty comparable to what Dr. Carlson described, but it is much earlier than in previous pre-COVID years, and it's definitely accounting for a majority of the patients presenting ill to our emergency department and being hospitalized. Mm-hmm. And as a contrast to that, we're seeing very few patients hospitalized with COVID-19 at this point, and those who are typically coming in for other reasons and are incidentally being found to be positive.
Why do you think, given that RSV is common, it's typically mild in seasons, mm-hmm. especially before the pandemic, why do you think there's an alarming rise in pediatric cases? Why is it happening now, Dr. Webb?
That's a great question. And I will qualify this by saying I'm not an epidemiologist, but at least in terms of what we're seeing here, it's not a different beast than in previous years. All of us in pediatrics, whether you do outpatient or inpatient medicine, are very, very, very used to RSV. And we set our calendars by it every winter. What's really different is that this surge is just happening sooner. In previous years, as Dr. Carlson mentioned, it's typically a little later. Usually we start to see an uptick more like November, and then it really starts to peak in December and January. So we're seeing that about 6 to 8 weeks earlier than usual, at least in my region. And the why of that is kind of puzzling, I think, to a lot of people. We honestly anticipated that we would see this return to what we used to think of as normal last year. And many hospitals, including my own, were surge planning and trying to come up with staffing models to account for what we expected, which was a return to our pre-COVID numbers. And it just really didn't happen. And we saw this kind of low level that actually petered out early in the winter, and then we were seeing some cases even into the spring. So I think the biggest thing that we have seen since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic is really a disruption in the predictable patterns of our seasonal respiratory viruses. So far, it feels like we are returning to what things used to be like, and it's just happening sooner. But as far as severity, we haven't really, at least in our region, noticed greater severity. It's just, there's more cases, they're earlier. And then we have an entire generation of COVID infants and new parents who have not experienced this before, have maybe never heard of this virus. And there are a lot of news stories covering this surge, and we've had a lot of parents coming in concerned that they need a test just to know, or that the virus itself is inherently more dangerous than it actually is. I will say that RSV accounts for a disproportionate amount of disease burden in children. And long before COVID-19 was something any of us had ever heard of, it's what keeps hospitals, children's hospitals and community hospitals full in the wintertime. So it's not different. It's just earlier.
Yeah. Dr. Carlson, I see you nodding. I was reading a New York Times article where doctors across the country, some of them suspect that those who would have ordinarily been exposed to RSV over the last couple of years, and Dr. Webb touched upon this, were insulated. We were social distancing during the pandemic, and this may be one cause that's driving up the numbers. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes. No, I mean, I would echo Dr. Webb's sentiment that I am, again, not an epidemiologist, but I would agree that, we do kind of have this generation of young children who have not experienced normal respiratory seasons. So we think about, 2 years of masking, 2 years of minimal school or masking at school. And this is really the first fall and winter that we're seeing children at school without masks. We're not having quite the strict rules about staying home if you're sick. So a lot more kids are going to school with kind of these mild illnesses. And while, like Dr. Webb was saying, it may not impact our older children the same way, they then come home and they have younger siblings who are, in that high risk age range. And so we have this whole cohort of infants who really just haven't had any respiratory viruses that they've been exposed to. And one of the other things is that we know our mothers who are breastfeeding, they generally can pass antibodies through breast milk. And, the mothers have also been masking and kind of staying indoors for the past 2 years. So they don't necessarily have the antibodies to pass on to their infants as well. So I think it's a little bit of a perfect storm. We have more children out there. We have more kids in school. We have infants who haven't been exposed. We have moms who haven't been exposed. And a little bit of the pandemic fatigue that we've seen. So people are wanting to get out. They're wanting to go do all the things that they enjoyed doing pre-pandemic.
And I know that your increase in RSV cases were in the single digit percentile. I think you said 8 to 9% in Reno. I'm curious, with because the CDC is also concerned about, you know, a triple threat of in addition to flu and COVID, what does influenza and COVID look like in Reno right now, Dr. Carlson?
So we're just starting to see a small uptick in influenza. Again, influenza is typically a little bit of a later winter virus. So we're just starting to see our first influenza in the past few weeks. We have not had a heavy disease burden. What's interesting is we're actually seeing kids who come in with RSV and flu. Mm-hmm. So again, what that mm-hmm. CDC is talking about, that, you know, triple-demic that we may be seeing. And we know that viruses can be additive. And so if you have RSV and you have flu, you may end up with more symptomatology and, you know, more trouble breathing for these small infants than if you just had one or the other.
Mm. How can a parent or an adult tell the difference, you know, between flu, COVID, and RSV, if their child is symptomatic and is just sick?
So I don't know that there is really any way to tell the difference. You know, I think even as physicians, until we do that, the swab in the nose and find out, you know, it's really hard to differentiate. They often present with those same symptoms of, you know, some congestion, some runny nose, then a little bit of fever, then they get into coughing. So I think, again, just really treating the symptomatology. That's really what we do for RSV and bronchiolitis in general is provide supportive care. So watching our hydration, making sure our babies, you know, are drinking enough, eating enough, making enough wet diapers, making sure that they're not having trouble breathing. So looking for those sucking in of the ribs, sucking in of the stomach, you know, kind of bobbing of the head. Those are all signs that young infants or children are having difficulty breathing. So we really watch out for those signs more than anything else.
Dr. Webb, given that you've seen more than a 20% increase in your area in the Central Valley, I know that you said that it's not, these cases of RSV aren't more severe, but they are higher and there's an uptick. Mm-hmm. It's earlier in the season. Ultimately, what does that mean for your staff taking in more patients earlier in the year?
That is the million-dollar question, or probably more than million-dollar question. And I would say the biggest thing, just to kind of to answer that and echoing what Dr. Carlson just said, is the treatment for all three of those viruses really is actually supportive care. There is an FDA-approved treatment for influenza. It's not especially efficacious, and it's really only recommended in severe cases. So getting to the staffing piece, as Dr. Carlson said, if your child is hydrating okay, is congested and coughing, but not having difficulty breathing and is able to keep liquids down, then really it's kind of staying at home, both for reducing their exposure to other germs, you know, if they're coming to an emergency department setting or an urgent care setting, and also reducing exposing others to their germs, because we really need to kind of reserve those resources in our emergency department settings in particular for the more severely ill children. Because when we start to see these viruses kind of piling up at the same time, we know how to treat them, but we do get to a point where we are short on beds, on you know, the equipment required if they need respiratory support and things like that. So we do get very anxious even before COVID-19 when we start to see things peaking earlier, or when we start to see the overlapping cases of influenza and RSV, some of the other viruses that are out there, because we know that you know, the bed capacity and the staffing are a limited resource. So we never want to dissuade parents from seeking care if they're concerned. But I think a really important message is there's not a need to do a test just to know the result of the test. It should really be guided by how ill appearing the child is, and the primary care provider. You know, we are both hospitalists. Those offices are very strapped right now as well. But a phone call to the primary care provider to kind of describe symptoms and figure out if they really need to be assessed urgently is a really underutilized a tool.
Can RSV lead to other illnesses that people should be aware of, Dr. Webb?
Yeah, so most obvious thing is it can progress to pretty severe difficulty breathing, and for, you know, the majority of children don't need to be hospitalized. Among those who do, most of them are able to be managed with some straightforward modalities like oxygen and maybe some IV fluids. Some of those will require more invasive help, things like breathing tubes, having to be connected to a ventilator. It is possible for it to sort of set you up to develop a secondary infection like pneumonia. However, RSV is probably the best studied illness in pediatrics. There are thousands of people that have made their entire careers out of trying to understand this. And the biggest thing that we know is we're all very desperate to find something that will make it better. And that leads to a lot of treating of things that ultimately aren't really helpful to the child. So it's pretty rare that it turns into something else. But we will end up trying a lot of other treatments if the child's getting sicker, because it's very hard for families and for pediatricians. We all want to help our patients to be dealing with an illness that ultimately really you're hydrating and you're providing oxygen and suctioning mucus. And those are really the only evidence-based therapies for it.
Yeah, Dr. Carlson, it may be difficult for a parent to know when to stop treating symptoms at home and actually take a child to the hospital. When do you believe a parent should bring their child to either their primary care doctor, urgent care, or even an emergency room for possible RSV, which can also be flu or COVID, since there's really no way of separating between the two at home?
Yeah, I think that's a really important discussion that we have with parents all the time of, you know, when do we want you to seek care? So I think, again, paying attention to the hydration status. So we want to make sure that even if they're not eating as much, we want them to be drinking. Mm-hmm. Best way to tell infants is by measuring their wet diapers. Mm-hmm. So we want at least three or four wet diapers in any 24-hour period. Less than that, we do start to worry that they're getting dehydrated. So that's kind of the one aspect that we see with bronchiolitis, just because kids get so congested that they have difficulty breathing and eating and drinking. The other real big thing to look at is kind of how hard they're working to breathe. You know, we look for things like flaring of the nostrils. We look for things like kind of sucking in above the collarbones, in between the ribs, under the ribs. If you are looking at your child and you can see from across this room, you watch them and you can see that they're breathing, that's telling us that they are working harder to breathe. And if you notice that your child is working harder to breathe, or if they're breathing very rapidly, they're not staying hydrated, those would all be reasons to seek care. I think that if there's any questions, just like Dr. Webb said, you know, reaching out to the pediatrician or your primary care doctor via the phone, they can really help triage whether or not you need to be seen. And then I think the only other thing, you know, that we always look for is any kind of color change. Color change is a little bit of a later sign. So that is something that is really an emergency room or calling 911 if there's color change, either blue, gray, purple. But, you know, really looking for those signs of respiratory distress and then watching the hydration status.
Finally, before I let you both go, you were talking about planning for a surge last season, and then now we're getting an earlier uptick in RSV cases this year. Are you anticipating, or I guess what conversations are you having with your staff preparing for potentially, you know, that kind of surge scenario that you were planning for last year for this year? Dr. Carlson?
Yeah, so I think it's always good to plan in advance, as we've learned with COVID and the pediatric world. We planned and really tried to help out our adult colleagues. So I think some of that same planning for the COVID surge really can be used in our planning for our bronchiolitis or RSV surge. So ensuring that we have, you know, a fully staffed physicians and mid-level providers has been really important. Our nursing administration is working really hard to ensure that we have adequate nursing staff. And then really we're looking at potential for other spaces that we may need to open up to have extra beds, and ensuring that our emergency room is fully staffed as well, because that's another real big kind of crunch point for our respiratory season.
Yeah. Dr. Webb?
Yeah, I agree with everything Dr. Carlson said. I think that the COVID-19 pandemic has taught us a lot about planning and how to be nimble and really sort of creative with the resources that we have. And so I would echo what she said as far as that is concerned. I do think it's important, though, to acknowledge that healthcare is experiencing a staffing shortage unlike anything that really has been seen in modern history. And that is largely driven by sort of, for lack of a better term, burnout and a lot of factors mm-hmm. throughout the pandemic. So we do, we're starting with a pool that is a lot smaller than it was 3 years ago. And then we've, you know, have things like supply chain shortages and delays to contend with. So I'm in that sense, I'm very grateful for all the lessons that we have learned about really how to be creative. And we will definitely, I think, be leveraging a lot of those. But to echo the point about the emergency department, we know in this country that a disproportionate percentage of folks will seek care in that type of a setting and could potentially be managed elsewhere. And there's so many reasons for that beyond the scope of what we're talking about today. But that really getting back to kind of, you don't need to come in just to get a test or just because the child has a fever, but the reasons Dr. Carlson mentioned, you know, are really, really critical. So surge planning is definitely underway, and we're identifying all the opportunities we can to leverage additional nursing resources in particular, which is more of a challenge than physician staffing, at least in our area. But we are, a little anxious because we've seen a lot of folks leave the healthcare field in the last few years.
Dr. Webb and Dr. Carlson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Dr. Nicole Webb is with Valley Children's Health in Madera County, and Dr. Bronwyn Carlson is with Renowned Children's Hospital in Reno. You're listening to Insight here on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Type in anti-Semitism and you'll find dozens and dozens of recent incidents, from rapper and fashion designer Ye, formerly known as Kanye West, and his offensive and inflammatory statements about Jews, to new revelations that the man who attacked Nancy Pelosi's husband a few days ago shared extremist views about Jews, and locally, a number of recent situations in the greater Sacramento area with anti-Semitic incidents on or near the campuses of UC Davis and Sacramento State. And there are concerns that the acquisition of Twitter by Elon Musk, who is no stranger to controversy, could lead to more hate speech online. According to data collected by the Anti-Defamation League, last year, white supremacist propaganda doubled year over year. And data shows that already in 2022, there have already been nearly 6,000 incidents nationwide. So, are we hearing more about anti-Semitism, or is this a new wave, or is it just making more headlines? Joining us to discuss are Seth Brisk, regional director with the Anti-Defamation League based in San Francisco, and Rabbi Mona Alfi with Sacramento's congregation B'nai Israel. Rabbi Alfi is also the president of the Board of Rabbis of the Greater Sacramento Region. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Seth, I want to start with you, since you're a regional director for the Anti-Defamation League based on the West Coast. From a 30,000-foot view, what is the state of anti-Semitism today?
Well, thank you, Vicki. And, it's somewhat appropriate that we're moving from the virus of COVID and other viruses that we're contending with to the virus of hate. And we've seen similarly outbreaks of this virus in the last few years. We are witnessing, at least the numbers that we have in the last year, the largest number of anti-Semitic incidents in over a decade. In fact, since we've ever been recording, and that dates back to the 1970s. But you can also look at the numbers of hate crimes that are being reported and cataloged by the FBI. And they also are showing that their latest numbers indicate a high mark in terms of hate crimes that occurred in their last year available. And that's the highest in over a decade. So we're seeing this happen, and we're seeing it happen for a number of reasons, including technology, the use of technology, which you mentioned, as a means to spread this virus of hate, but also the ways in which extremists are being emboldened. And as you mentioned in your introduction, the artist formerly known as Kanye West, other leading figures, casually using anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic conspiracies as part of spreading their beliefs and therefore influencing others.
Hmm. Rabbi Alfie, in recent months, we've seen a number of incidents here in the greater Sacramento area. Swastikas were found on the Sac State and UC Davis campuses. A local school board member also compared COVID restrictions to the Holocaust. What's happening here in Sacramento, and why now, do you think?
I think why now is in part because of COVID, and that ratcheted up people's anxiety, and also because the entire world is kind of feeling unstable and insecure right now. And I think that when we see the world in a place of fear and insecurity, we see not just anti-Semitism, but all sorts of racism really raise its ugly head. I also think that social media is a huge part of it. It used to be unacceptable to say certain things publicly. And now I think people have found community online where they feel emboldened to say whatever it is that they want to say. We also don't see elected officials having to take responsibility for words of hate. Mm-hmm. And I think if you have elected officials who can say whatever they want, it emboldens everybody else as well.
Yeah. Sacramento is no stranger to anti-Semitism. Take us back to 1999. Some call it the summer of hate, and talk to us about what happened and if anything has changed in our area since then.
So first, the good news. In our area, in Sacramento, interfaith relationships are still extremely strong. It's still, I think, a high priority amongst the interfaith and multi-ethnic community of Sacramento to build bridges, to be there for each other, and to really support each other. But that's really a local level. And I don't think that that some of the stuff that we're seeing, particularly what happened at UC Davis, that's not necessarily people who are local. In 1999, the people who attacked three synagogues and murdered a gay couple and attacked a Planned Parenthood, they weren't from Sacramento. They were out from the foothills. But being the state capital, we're a place that catches attention. And so it's a bigger statement if you come and do those things here in the state capital. But one of the things we saw in 99, which I think does draw a straight line to us now, was the beginning of social media, the beginning of hate groups to really connect on a national level on the internet, and to create a sense of community for each other, emboldening each other.
Yeah. So, I mean, you were talking about this briefly with our Insight team that, you know, 20 years ago, around the time that these synagogues were firebombed in Sacramento, the internet was still young and it was still in its infancy. But it didn't mean that those people and those views and those actions didn't actually exist. And now the internet and social media has kind of created this kind of dark, dangerous community and perhaps emboldened some of these actions.
Absolutely. One of the things that was chilling that we were told at the time by one of the men who did was responsible for the firebombing was he said he and his brother were not alone, that there were others out there. And at the time, we thought that meant that there were other people who had been part of the planning of the attacks. What we've come to realize is what he meant was there were others on the internet, that he was a part of a larger network of white supremacists. Hmm.
I know you talked about Sacramento as being the state capital, but more broadly, Northern California, even Sacramento County is very diverse politically when you get outside the city. What is it about our area that seems to be prone to this kind of hate speech and acts beyond just being the state capital?
Well, you know, I think when we live in Sacramento, we think of ourselves as being an extension of the Bay Area. And we're not. We're Central Valley. We're part of rural America. And I think it's a mistake to think of things as red state, blue state, and really look at things divided amongst the states. There's really a divide between urban, suburban, and rural. And the further away you get from the urban, the more discomfort people have with multi-ethnic, multi-religious communities where things start to get much more polarized. And I really do believe that a lot of the stuff we're seeing in Sacramento is not necessarily coming from Sacramento, but from the surrounding areas.
Yeah. Seth, in a recent NPR interview, anti-Semitism was called one of the oldest forms of hate. Can you talk about why it still continues today?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons why. I mean, anti-Semitism in many respects is more or less what the person who's spreading it makes of it. So there are a lot of different ways in which it can manifest. And the Jewish community has had a history of spreading around the world into different communities. So it means that there typically are Jews in any given community who are conveniently there to be targeted, to be scapegoated, particularly for the use of extremists, but also to be manipulated by politicians or by others who may want to advance an agenda. I will say that, you know, I mentioned at the start that that hate is like a virus, and the way in which it spreads, it's important to remember that anti-Semitism is not something that simply affects the Jewish community. And as we heard in that case, and that horrific, infamous case, which I still remember back from 1999, you saw that while, you know, initially or maybe primarily the synagogues were being targeted and the Jewish community was being targeted, but the hate also touched upon a gay couple who were murdered. It also touched upon women. This is not uncommon to see hate spreading from one community to another, targeting one group of people to another. So it's really important to understand that when you see anti-Semitism, you know, another thing that we talk about, it, not only about it's an oldest form of hate, but in some ways, anti-Semitism is the canary in the coal mine of civil society. In other words, when you see anti-Semitism rearing its ugly head, this is an indication that society is sick, that civil society may be at risk and may be under pressure and under duress, because it may start with the Jews, but it never ends with the Jews.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is there's no borders to anti-Semitism or limitations. Can you talk about some of the different types of anti-Semitism that you're tracking and monitoring?
Sure. So we've seen, I mean, you mentioned some of the incidents. We've seen some of these banner drops over highways that have taken place around UC Davis and the Sacramento area, but also across the country. Most recently, they've been saying things like, again, referencing the former, the artist formerly known as Kanye West, you know, that he was right, that he's right about his anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, and using that as a means of spreading their propaganda. But, you know, one of the ironies is that this group is really largely white supremacist. They have no love for African Americans or, you know, many of the other things that might in particular be of interest to this artist or some of his followers. So we've seen that. We've seen the use of flyering in neighborhoods around institutions that are Jewish institutions, spreading anti-Semitic lies, but also, again, targeting other groups as well. Targeting women, targeting African Americans. And then, of course, we're seeing the use of technology, which is really sort of the outsized player in this issue. People who are extremists are using technology to reach, to recruit, to radicalize people. And these operations, they move from online to on the street. You saw this in the attack on Paul Pelosi. You know, this was somebody who had been expressing anti-Semitism, been expressing Islamophobia, other forms of hatred, and then going out and taking their hatred into the real world. And so we see extremists spreading disinformation and propaganda through technology, recruiting and indoctrinating people. They gain access to a larger or even a global community. So you can have people influencing others from halfway around the world from the comfort of their own home. And then they're also using the power of cover and anonymity. And they even use the technology to commit acts of hatred. So they'll disseminate and normalize stereotypes. They'll make robocalls to broadcast bigotry. They'll engage in doxing, which is targeted publication of documents for intimidation. Or sometimes we've even seen them live stream terror attacks. So technology absolutely plays an important role here.
The ADL put out a release when talking about technology and specifically social media, concerned about Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter and that the social media platform could open itself up to essentially no longer seeking to limit misinformation and hate speech. Why is your organization watching this closely?
Well, we already had concerns about Twitter, before Elon Musk took ownership of the company. It's been a place where hate has been disseminated and spread rather frequently. We're also concerned about the fact that, you know, even before Musk's takeover, there was a Trust and Safety Council. There were rules, online monitoring in place that was meant to try to stop some of the hate. He's talking about eliminating that. And he's talking about replatforming people who have been deplatformed from this from Twitter in order to enable them to come back onto the internet and be able to continue to spread their hate. There's also been a concern about the ways in which Twitter was used to promote disinformation and misinformation in and around elections. And so there's just a number of different ways in which sort of the poor job that Twitter was doing before this takeover, he's now explicitly saying he's going to start dismantling many of those protections that were in place. And so it's a cause for concern.
Hmm. Rabbi Alfi, take us into your congregation, B'nai Israel. What are you all talking about? And I guess finally, like, what resources are out there for people to educate themselves?
So I think one of the big concerns people are in my congregation are having right now is actually looking towards the elections next week. There are a lot of people running for office across the country who espouse a form of white nationalism that they call Christian nationalism, who are stating very clearly that they believe this is a Christian nation rather than a nation that is predominantly Christian. And for those of us who are in a minority group, that's a scary thing. It calls into question whether or not they think we're really citizens or not, or whether or not we really belong in this country. So I think there's a great deal of fear about that. 10 years ago, a lot of the people who made comments like Marjorie Taylor Greene about Jews having space lasers, that would have killed a political career. Now it makes her a celebrity. And so I think there's a lot of fear because as unnerving as the swastikas at Sac State or the banners being hung from freeways, much more terrifying is who's going to make our laws. Who's determining the status of a person's citizenship? We already see, as Seth said, there's a overlapping between misogyny, anti-Semitism, and other forms of racism. And so we already see women's rights being eroded in different states. What's to say that religious minority groups won't have to suffer some of the same things? So I think there's a great deal of fear and panic around that in my congregation, a lot of concern about what this means on a national level, not just locally. And in terms of education, you know, we live in a world where there are people who believe in alternative facts. And so it's hard to say, where do you go for education? For me, when I want to look at facts, I actually go to the ADL's website. For me, that's the first site that I go, not just to track anti-Semitism, but racism in general, because as Seth said, there's an overlap. And so for me, that is, it's a source that I know is credible. And that I know that they do due diligence before they post something on the website. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're looking to understand what's going on in terms of anti-Semitism, that's where I would go first.
Rabbi Alfi, thank you so much for making the trip. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
And Seth, thank you for joining us from San Francisco.
Thank you.
Seth Brisk is the regional director with the Anti-Defamation League, and Rabbi Mona Alfi is with Sacramento's congregation, B'nai Israel. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This weekend, the California Museum opened a new exhibit showcasing some of the history of Filipinos in California, one of the largest Asian ethnic groups in the state. The exhibit is presented in partnership with the Bulusan Center for Filipino Studies at UC Davis, the Filipino American National Historical Society, and the California Nurses Association. It is called California is in the Heart, and Cap Radio's Sacramento community reporter Janelle Salonga joins us to share more about it. Good morning, Janelle.
Good morning. Thanks, Vicky. Glad to be here. This exhibit is super close to my heart as somebody who's also Filipino in California myself. So it was really meaningful for me to get to cover it and see the opening.
I love the name. Where did the exhibit name come from?
So it actually comes from the same person who's the namesake for the Bulusan Center, Carlos Bulusan. So he was an immigrant, a Filipino immigrant to the States in the 1930s. He lived and worked in Seattle, but also spent a lot of time, you know, working jobs throughout the California Central Valley and the Central Coast, in agriculture and in canneries. And he was a labor organizer who was really active in Seattle's Filipino-American Cannery Trade Union. And so all that to say that he is most famous for his semi-autobiographical novel called America is in the Heart, which is where the exhibit name comes from. And that book title actually inspired, you know, several other authors like Elaine Castillo from the Bay Area, who wrote America is Not in the Heart and is also in the exhibit, and the late historian Dr. Don Mabalon, who wrote Little Manila is in the Heart. And
when talking about Dr. Mabalon, what their work was so crucial to this exhibit. Tell us more about them.
Yeah, so, you know, Dr. Mabalon, she definitely got her flowers, so to speak, in the exhibit. And there's a saying, all roads lead to Stockton. And Manang Don, as many in the community and the communities that she was in called her, she grew up in Southside Stockton and saw many Filipino elders, Manongs and Manangs, congregate in the area. And it was this hub for Filipino activity, but was so rarely recognized in Filipino American studies or any kind of former scholarship. And Manang Don actually passed away suddenly in 2018 from a heart attack, unfortunately. And she dedicated her life to chronicling the history of Filipinos in the Central Valley with particular attention to Stockton. So she was actually the one who created and founded this nonprofit called Little Manila Rising to preserve that history with her friend Dylan Delvo. So he's also featured in the exhibit.
What are some of the there's many towns that I learned this about a week or two ago that, you know, the Central Valley was a big hub for Filipino enclaves. What are some other towns in California that were a hub for this?
Yeah, so actually Sacramento is featured in the exhibit as a hub as well. Vallejo, San Francisco, San Diego, Riverside, San Luis Obispo, and Delano are some of the others that were featured.
Yeah, I'm from Eagle Rock, which is a district in Los Angeles, and there is a very significant Filipino community. I have tons of Filipino friends.
Yeah.
So in Southern California as well. What are some of the ways the exhibit shows Filipino immigrants really building community in these different California towns?
So one artifact kind of tells that story, and it's actually a, you know, a blue, red and white basketball jersey. So here's one of the curators, archivist Jason Sarmiento with the Bulusan Center, who has a personal connection to it.
We were briefly stationed at Barch Air Force Base, and my dad played as a guard. But the jersey itself does represent a lot of things for the community. For one, basketball is the most popular sport in the Philippines, so it's one way to convey culture from the mainland or the homeland into the diaspora community. But also, like, these types of basketball associations and rec leagues was one way that diaspora Filipino communities, like, made connections with someone from a different town, as this one way they could, like, find out if they could just by chance meet someone from their hometowns or home provinces. So this is one way to make California their home while also preserving a lot of their cultures from their specific areas in the Philippines.
Yeah, so the exhibit also pays homage to women's clubs, which are many Filipinas' way of finding community in the States and in California as well.
When was the last time an exhibit like this was at the California Museum?
Yeah, so you mentioned, you know, in your intro that this is kind of something that was long overdue, and there has actually been, you know, an exhibit celebrating Filipinos at the California Museum before, but it's been a long time. The museum's executive director, Amanda Meeker, told me that it's actually been over a decade since there's been an exhibit highlighting Filipinos in this way. And that first one was actually a traveling exhibit from the Smithsonian that was just photos with minimal text. But this one is a lot more expansive.
Yeah, and it's like centrally located in downtown Sacramento, which is awesome, the capital city. You know, speaking about expansive, you've mentioned notable Filipino Californians and also Filipino towns. But what are some other parts of the exhibit?
Yeah, so here's Jason again with, you know, kind of a succinct summary on more of what the exhibit has.
And we also have a historic timeline that is showcased prominent events in California and U.S. history for Filipinos. And they will be juxtaposed with art pieces that convey various themes about the timeline.
And the Filipino-American National Historical Society has a museum in Stockton that opened in 2016 that actually was a huge influence on this historic timeline. They have an exhibit about the four waves of immigration of Filipino migrants to California. And so that exhibit and the museum in general really inspired the structure of California is in the heart.
Hmm. Yeah, the cool thing is you actually got to see it in person and talk to people taking it all in. What are you hearing from visitors?
Yeah, so here's actually some of the background noise that I heard when I was there.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, it was a lot of people. And as you can hear from people saying, you know, take a picture or I'm going to cry, people were so excited to see themselves or people they knew, you know, memorialized and acknowledged this way. It, you know, something I was really hearing from people that I was passing as I was walking through the exhibit is just that, you know, it really made them feel like, you know, they mattered and that their contributions were important. It was a really surreal experience for so many folks, and especially because so many of the people who are in the exhibit, like Cynthia Bonta, who was, you know, a Sacramento area community leader, and also Rob Bonta's mother, were present at the exhibit and at the opening.
And I would imagine, you know, being Filipino-American, there may be a thing or two or even more that you learned that you didn't already know, and you had some personal takeaways from the exhibit.
Yeah. Like I said earlier, it was really meaningful for me to be, you know, covering this exhibit and to be present at the opening. I think I have a lot of feelings around what it means to be, quote unquote, Filipino American and what it means to strive for, you know, belonging and assimilation. But I mean, I also cried seeing so many people at the opening who were moved by seeing themselves or, you know, people who looked like them honored and talked about like they were and are important to this state's and this country's history. And so I actually learned a lot about, you know, queer LGBTQ plus Filipino community leaders. And one thing that was really cool for me was learning that a Filipino lesbian actually was one of the people who started the first American lesbian club called the Daughters of Bulitis. And with regard to SAC, you know, there's photos of this Filipino-owned convenience store in downtown, which I thought was really cool because, you know, that's you know, that's such a central area in the city. And, you know, the most I heard growing up about Filipinos in history was maybe a mention of the Philippine-American War. And then, you know, boom, the Philippines was given independence. And the U.S. still even has military bases there. So it's not even true independence. But, you know, I feel like this exhibit is so huge for Filipinos in California to, you know, be able to see themselves in another lens outside of just talking about like, oh, they were in wars or they are, you know, a country that was colonized. You know, as I'm really excited to actually, you know, maybe even take my sister, who's 11, to see the exhibit because I don't remember anything like this being around when I was that age. And I feel like it would have meant a lot to me to experience that then.
Yeah, and in many ways, I mean, it's expansive, but we're just like, you know, getting to like the tip of the iceberg. Was there anything people were sharing with you about what they'd like to see in the future?
Yeah, so while the exhibit has, you know, a couple sizable sections about Filipinos' role in fighting for labor rights and a few different sectors like farming and nursing, Sean DeLizzo, who's the lead educator for the California Museum, says,
a lot of this exhibit deals with identity and the Filipino-American identity and, you know, the different aspects of that. But one thing I'm hoping that it does bring forth is a lot of solidarity amongst different communities. And I would love to see that expressed in different ways. A lot of the different labor movements that have happened between Filipinos and a lot of other ethnic groups across history, I want to see that being captured in museums, not just the California Museum, but museums across our state and country more often.
Yeah, so Sean and Jason, who you heard earlier, said they'd also like to see the exhibit used as, you know, this jumping off point for future curriculum and other teachers in the state.
Thank you so much for sharing, Janelle, taking the trip. I mean, it seems so exciting. And the exhibit's going to be around through April of next year, right?
Yes, April 9th, 2023 is the date it closes.
Plenty of time. That is Cap Radio Sacramento Communities reporter Janelle Salonga sharing the California is in the Heart exhibit at the California Museum. And as we just said, running through April of next year. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.